And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, flavor, stories from the land, interconnectedness, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And Sita Rani Brian.
And we're excited about today's show as we are talking about milk. Milk production, its uses, and controversies, as we are the only species that consumes milk past its intended use of feeding a newborn. Milk, the whole story. We have some wonderful guests with us that will tell us the whole story. Hopefully, all that and more today on An Organic Conversation.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because every day we unconsciously participate or choose to eat or act in many ways that are almost habits for us. And yet we don't often know the story that's connected to those things that we just take for granted.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you can get used to doing something a certain way and not really think about doing it or think about the implications of doing it. And this giving you the whole story on milk is giving you an opportunity to have all the information so that when you make a choice, you're making it consciously.
Yeah. And, you know, consciously or unconsciously, I do think, I mean, we are aware of doing those things, right? We are every day driving and we are texting or we don't get breakfast or whatever it may be. We're doing it actually consciously. And yet there's so much more to it but I do think, Mark, you're right. It's a habit. We are getting used to a certain rhythm without really looking at it, knowing the whole story or questioning it. So yeah, exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the whole story. But first, let's have the green headlines with Jen Lloyd.
Thank you, Mark. Tribal leaders in the United States have gathered to make one final push against the State Department's approval of an oil pipeline that could have a devastating cultural impact on Native Americans. The 1,700-mile pipeline, if approved, will run through tribal lands and sacred areas in the U.S. and Canada, and the leaders have expressed concern due to the relatively poor environmental record held by the pipeline's developer, TransCanada Corporation. The Occupy Wall Street movement is quickly gaining support across the country, and environmental activists, including the Energy Action Coalition and 350.org, among others, have jumped on board to make their voices heard. Leaders of the organizations are hopeful that the movement will help continue to elevate demands for climate action. And Burmese President Thein Sein has announced the suspension of the Mattisone Dam project until the end of his term, citing a wish to respect the will of the people. This triumph is the culmination of a 5-year effort by activists, scholars, and scientists in Burma who worked tirelessly to make the world aware of the irreparable damage the project would cause. The coalition, however, will continue to work until the dam project is fully canceled. And those are the green headlines. Back to you, Helga.
Thanks, Jen. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Brian.
And we'll take a quick break, but stay tuned for our first interview about milk, the whole story, with some great guests today, including Sally Fallon Morrell, renowned author, nutritionist, and the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, only here on An Organic Conversation. That and more when we come back right after the break.
It's been a long day, baby. Things ain't been going my way, you know I need you here. Clear my mind all the time. And baby, the way you move me, it's crazy. Like you see right through.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Brian.
And today's show is about milk, the whole story. We are excited about our show today, as we are talking about a white liquid that is part of most food cultures and traditions anywhere around the world. It has multiple uses, can be transformed into completely new forms of food, and is known for its nutritional value. And yet, we're the only species that consumes it past its intended use, which is to feed a newborn. While many people love milk and yogurt and cheese, others believe it's wrong to extend the lactation of an animal for our nourishment. And if that was not enough, not all milk is created equal. Milk, the whole story, today on An Organic Conversation. With us now, calling in from Washington, D.C., is Sally Fallon Morrell, author, chef, nutrition researcher, journalist, and also the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation. Sally, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, and thank you for that introduction.
Yes. Sally, you have been working and living in the world of food for decades at this point.
A long time. Yes.
Why? I want to start with asking you, why food for you? What is it about food, before we dive into milk, that catches your passion on that deep level?
You know, I was just thinking about this the other day, and I realized on looking back that my parents were probably among the very first foodies. Food was just part of our family culture. My parents had been to Europe. My mother was a fabulous cook, and we talked a lot about food. I remember my father in particular railing against what he called ersatz food. That means fake food. So it's something I grew up with.
That's great.
Well, and, you know, and all those things that are around us every day, you know, I know my daughters didn't think they were picking up anything from me when I was talking about organic food those 30 years ago, but now it's a regular part of our conversations. It's very interesting.
Well, it wasn't organic, of course, and I suspect I'm a little bit older than you, but we weren't talking about organic. We were not talking about pasture-fed in those days, but they were, you know, it was definitely a family where you didn't dare use margarine or serve it. And, we had whole milk, unfortunately not raw milk, but we ate real foods and as whole as possible.
Unprocessed, yes.
Sure. So let's get into milk. Can you give us a little history of milk? You know, when did people start consuming milk, and how old is it as a food?
In one sentence, right?
Yeah.
Well, certainly milk drinking goes back a long time. Pretty much agreed, 10,000 years. There are some people who make the argument for 30,000 years. And I think it's important to stress that we're not just talking about milk from cows. Depending on where you were in the world, it was milk from camels or reindeer or water buffalo, sheep, goats, mules. Donkeys and horses. And there are certain traditional cultures that depended completely on these lactating animals. It's interesting, when you move forward, we find milk throughout Europe, of course, milk and cheese and the many byproducts. But as for drinking fluid milk, America really was the country that drank it the most. We have much more of a tradition of serving fluid milk to our children than cheese, for example.
Sally, I've been such a fan of yours since I got into the food world, became a chef like 10 years ago. Yeah. And knowing the story of Weston A. Price and how that influenced what the foundation is doing now, what he discovered when he was traveling, can you tell us about that? Can you tell us about how milk is used around the world, what role and importance it's had in traditions and other cultures?
And what your foundation does. Yeah. Great question.
Oh, thank you. Well, he went around the world and studied traditional cultures. He found 14 healthy populations, and they had very different foods. There were only really two milk drinking cultures that he studied. One was the Swiss culture, and the other was the North African cultures. And the one thing that he noted, or that can be noted about these cultures that drink milk compared to their neighbors, was that they were taller.
Mm.
So we know that even from animal studies, that milk builds longer and stronger bones.
And so when do you know historically, when did we learn or when did we observe nature to think that, the milk that is intended for the newborn could be good for us or should be good for us, or we find a way of taking it by, extending the lactation by basically keep milking the animal?
You know, I'm not sure that that's actually correct, that we extend normal lactation. I just, owning cows myself, the cow will nurse her calf for up to a year. And by that time, she's ready to give birth to another calf. So I am not sure that we actually extend the lactation more than normal. In fact, we dry off our cows so they have 3 months rest, and I'm not sure that would necessarily take place in nature.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know. I'm speculating here.
Yeah, interesting, because the common belief is that Cows are, in this case cows, but any animal has to give birth in order to start milk production. And then that milk production is extended longer than, you know, biologically what would happen in nature by simulating the newborn still sucking.
But the newborn, if not taken off the mother, will nurse for a much longer time in animal time than a baby, a human baby does.
Interesting.
Yes,
they,
and then
they will nurse into puberty.
And then you, having some cows yourself, when you said, you know, after a year they're ready to give birth again, do dairies kind of restart their cows in that sense,
right,
getting them
right.
pregnant again if milk production goes down after a year or two, and then...
Well, the normal way is that you breed your cows in the summer, and then and you're milking at that time. And then when winter comes, you stop milking, and by that time the calves are gone. And then they have their calves in the spring, and you start milking again. So you milk them for about 9 months. Now, that's not what happens in the industry. In the industry, they tend to have cows that are for breeding alone, and then you just milk the cows for maybe up to 600-800 days, and then the cow dies.
Oh my gosh.
That's what happens in the industry. But that's not what happens in the artisanal grass-based model.
We're talking with Sally Fallon Morrell, the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, a renowned journalist and author and chef. Today on An Organic Conversation About Milk, The Whole Story, I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan. And Sally, I'm curious, since we're talking about, I mean, not extending the length, but about the animals using this as nourishment to get strong, what are about the concerns that some people have that we are the only species who, as adults, consume something that was intended to be nourishment for the offspring of the animal? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say yes. So great, that's wonderful. That's wonderful that humans have figured out that this is such a wonderful food. I mean, that's just not an argument for not drinking milk, in my opinion, or not eating cheese. We do a lot of things different from animals. We're not animals. We need shoes and houses and clothing, and we cook and. Everything is different for humans, so I just don't think that's a valid argument.
Yeah, I try to wrap my mind around that and to try to find an example in nature where we are doing that, where we have done that, where we take something that is biologically only available for a certain amount of time, and one could say, you know, any greenhouse does that.
Yeah.
And yet, because it is the birth of a newborn, because it's new life. There is a sense or a voice in me that cannot ignore a small, and I do eat cheese and I do drink milk, but there's a sense of insult on the feminine that's somehow connected for me with that, because it is the pregnancy, it is the giving birth of new life. I understand where these, you know, those sometimes very deeply rooted arguments come from, that there's something, I don't want to say wrong with it, but it's definitely, I understand why it's a sensitive topic for some.
Well, the domestic lactating animal is a gift, and in the past people believed it was a gift from the gods, because that animal produces far more milk than she needs for her youngster. And she's there to serve us. Of course, we need to be kind to the animal, but I don't know, if you want to get esoteric, Edgar Cayce said that animals are happiest when they're serving mankind. And what better way to serve mankind than to provide this superbly nutritious food?
Well, and it's also been said that the greatest thing that we could even do as human beings is be of service to others. And
right. So why not for the animals also?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can understand people being concerned about how we treat these animals in the industrial system, which is really an abomination and something that can only be changed if people just refuse to consume those kinds of foods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sally, you're talking about this being a gift from the gods because it offers so much to humans on the nutrition level. Can you tell us about what it offers on the nutrition level? And then also, and I know you're anxious to talk about this and we're anxious to hear about it from you, segue that into raw milk.
Okay. Well, milk, and when I'm talking about milk, I'm only talking about raw milk here, not processed, pasteurized, homogenized milk. is truly a complete food. It is designed not only to provide everything the infant needs to grow and to optimize the bone development, but also it creates the immune system in the infant. And in anyone, just not just the infant, but during the growth years, that's the only time you can grow. So it optimizes growth as well. And I think today, when our food system has been so compromised and there's so many temptations for growing children, and it's really a terrible burden on mothers to, I don't want to say burden. It's a tremendous challenge to mothers to make sure that their children are getting a nutritious diet. Milk is like the insurance policy. You can be assured that the baby is, and the child, the growing child, is getting, you know, optimal nutrition from milk.
Raw milk.
Yeah.
Raw milk, of course.
And so for those listeners of ours who may be experiencing raw milk through your words for the first time, can you talk about the difference in enzymes, protein, and fats in raw milk versus pasteurized?
Yeah, so what's in raw milk that's so amazing is a whole bunch of compounds. Most of them are enzymes, those are types of proteins, that have many roles. They build the immune system. They attach to vitamins and minerals to make sure that the child or the infant who has an immature digestive system, to make sure that this child can absorb them. So it's also great food for people who are having absorption problems. And these enzymes also kill pathogens. They support the growth of good bacteria in the gut. They help form a good biofilm in the gut. They protect, against the absorption of pathogens and toxins. So it's just multiple roles that are played by these enzymes. And enzymes are very fragile. This is not something I'm making up. FDA says there's no proof of this, but we know very well that heat destroys these enzymes. They don't work anymore after you've heated them, and especially if you heat them rapidly, which is what happens in pasteurization.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Helberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
And still with us, calling in from Washington, D.C., is Sally Fallon Morrell. Today on Milk, the Whole Story, here on An Organic Conversation, Sally Fallon Morrell is a journalist, chef, renowned author, and also the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, a foundation dedicated to wise food traditions and food farming and the healing arts. Sally,
I just want to finish that thought. One thing that happens when you heat treat milk is that those proteins and the casein and especially the whey proteins become allergenic. And what we're seeing in the United States right now is the relentless decline in the consumption of industrial milk because people are allergic to it. It makes them sick to their stomach or makes them have allergic reactions. And we did a survey of milk drinkers and found that 82% who had been diagnosed as lactose intolerant, whatever that may mean, could drink raw milk without any problems whatsoever. Wow. So there's tremendous potential for people to rediscover the benefits of milk with raw milk.
But there is a legal issue around milk. And Mark, you found a great, very current article about that.
Yeah, there was recently a ruling in Wisconsin where a Dane County judge was saying that he wouldn't allow owners of a cow to drink the raw milk. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do, but let me just preface this by saying in no state is it illegal to purchase, possess, or consume raw milk.
Hmm.
So he was wrong about that.
Mm-hmm. And
more
most...
and about two-thirds of the states, raw milk is legal to provide raw milk either by sale or through cow share programs or something like that. Now, that ruling had to do with a cow share program in the state of Wisconsin, and we were arguing that these people owned their cows, and so the farmer could provide the milk from the cows to the owners.
Can you clarify that one more time, Sally? I just want to make sure our listeners caught that. You're saying two-thirds of all states in the United States allow raw milk?
You can get raw milk through sales, from the farm. There's about 10 states where you can actually buy raw milk in stores.
Uh-huh.
And then some states allow and even encourage herd share or cow share programs. So you don't actually buy the milk. You buy the cow or the share of the herd, and then you enter into a contract with a farmer.
Right. You get like a tenth of the milk production or whatever it may be.
Whatever
your share.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah. These contracts are all different. And that's what was going on in Wisconsin. And the state of Wisconsin is probably one of the worst states in the country for getting raw milk, because it is a dairy state. And there is a big relationship between the laws in the state and whether it's a dairy state.
Yeah.
And they shut them down, and we took the state to court. And the judge ruled in his ruling, he basically said, you don't have any right to drink the milk of your own cow.
Right.
Yeah,
and then he retired and went to work for a law firm that represents Monsanto.
And Sally, people who are interested in finding raw milk producers in their area, they can get that information through the Weston A. Price Foundation, correct?
Yes, we have a secondary website, which is realmilk.com.
And that is westonaprice.org.
.org, yes.
Sally, wonderful work. Great to talk to you today. It's inspiring to hear your work and your passion around milk and food traditions in general. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Sally Fallon Morrell, the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, really celebrating and encouraging people to look at wise food traditions, food farming, and the healing arts. Again, that website is westonaprice.org. Today on An Organic Conversation, Milk, the Whole Story. I'm Helga Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
And we're excited about our next guest, where we look at the whole production cycle of milk when we come back. More on that here on An Organic Conversation. Stay tuned.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Trace, the new signature restaurant at the W San Francisco, is committed to creating an enriching and thoughtful culinary experience. By fusing the vibrant local personality of the Bay Area with a dedication to socially responsible food, Trace ensures all the ingredients are traceable back to their natural origins, locally sourced and sustainable. For reservations, visit trace-sf.com, T-R-A-C-E-S-F.com, or call 415-817-7836.
Bowman College has been offering professional training in nutrition and the culinary arts since 1989. Natural chefs will learn to master a healthful approach to classic culinary techniques, while nutrition consultants become experts in client consultation and the promotion of individualized plans for optimal health. Bowman College, a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. To find out more, visit bowmancollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N college.org.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
And we are telling you the whole story about milk today. We just had Sally Fallon Morell with us, the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, about raw milk. And we are looking into milk production now, raw, pasteurized, ultra-pasteurized, no-fat, low-fat, whole milk. Is whole milk really whole milk? With a wonderful guest and author who really dove into that world of milk. But first, here's Mark Mulcahy with his weekly update of what's in season.
And what's in season this week, we're going to be talking about cauliflower. And cauliflower, it's one of those things like when we talked about carrots. You know, carrots, you say, oh, they're in the stores year-round. But cauliflower in the fall going into the winter is actually when it has its best flavor. As the weather cools down, cauliflower gets a much sweeter, nuttier flavor than you would get out of cauliflower in the summer or in the spring. So this is the time to be eating it. And actually, cauliflower is actually part of the cabbage family, the most elegant member of the cabbage family, actually. And Mark Twain actually once said that cauliflower is cabbage with a college education. And I loved when I heard that. Now, cauliflower isn't just white. As you know, most of the time when we go into the store, you see white or beige-ish cauliflower. But now cauliflower comes in greens and violets and oranges and all types of different colors. And the green cauliflowers are both hybrids. There's Romanesco and Brocca flower, which both are a little bit milder and a little bit sweeter than normal cauliflower. And actually, when they're cooked, they do retain their green color. So you'll recognize broccoflower, but it looks like a head of broccoli more than cauliflower, but it is actually a cauliflower. And Romanesco, it's often called broccoli, but it is cauliflower. Romanesco is that thing that M.C. Escher would just be so proud. I think he actually created it. It has little spirals and little spikes on it, so it's definitely worth trying. There's orange cauliflower, which is also called cheddar cauliflower, which has 25 times the vitamin A that you would get out of cauliflower. And the reason that cauliflower is white is because they tie the leaves above it to keep the sunlight off it so that it develops no chlorophyll. If they left it open to the sun, then that would be actually green cauliflower. There's also purple, which will keep its purple color unless you overcook it. Then it starts to fade away and it turns more of a gray. So a couple quick tips on cauliflower that I want to let you know is we often will cut off that green stem or those green leaves and toss them in the compost. Don't. Cook them. Eat them. They're really good to eat. They're really great for soup stock, and they have that kind of cauliflower-y flavor, so don't throw them away. And cauliflower is one of those super vegetables. You know, it is rich in vitamins and minerals, good source of vitamin B6, C. As a matter of fact, a cup of it has 25 calories in a full day's allowance of vitamin C, so you can get a lot of vitamin C just from eating a cup of cauliflower, which is not much. When you cook it, you want to make sure that you don't use an iron pan because the phytonutrients in cauliflower react to the iron cookware and cause the cauliflower to kind of get a little bit brown. So you don't want to use iron if you can avoid it. And also, you'll notice that sometimes it smells, that kind of sulfury smell when you cook cauliflower. The best way to diminish that and get the most nutrients out of your cauliflower is to cook it for short amounts of time, such as a quick saute and a little bit of broth or water, and you'll also get your most nutritional value and your best flavor out of there and texture. So that's cauliflower. That's this week. And thanks to Mark Twain for that lovely quote.
And thanks to Mark Mulcahy for that lovely segment, Mark, with What's in Season. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
And we're talking milk, the whole story. We heard about the tradition of milk and how long it has been part of our world of food from Sally Fallon Morell, the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, before the break. And now with us from New York is Nina Plank, a farmer's daughter, food writer, farmers market entrepreneur, local foodist, and advocate for traditional foods. Nina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great. I'm staring at your website, and it says, she will liberate you to eat red meat, butter, raw milk, and lard.
I love it.
And lard is, I'm German, it's one of my favorite foods. It's literally just fat with some salt, really the antidote of what everyone tells you what you should be eating. And
And German potato salad wouldn't be German without it.
Exactly. It's delicious. And I don't know what the nutrition benefits are directly, but the pleasure benefits are endless.
Just a short one for your readers.
Yes.
Maybe looking forward to your next large show.
Yes.
It is mostly monounsaturated and unsaturated, oddly enough. It's only about 40% saturated. But in the saturated fats are a number of healthy fats. There are lots of individual fatty acids with roles in your body, and there's nothing wrong with the ones found in lard. What's wrong with lard is when it's been hydrogenated, just like when they hydrogenate corn oil to make fake butter.
So before you eat it, you might say the large prayer, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, our 2-year-old had a shirt that said, "Jesus is lard."
Yeah, we had Dario Cecchini on the show a while ago, I think a year or so plus, and the famous butcher from Italy, and he was in the Bay Area in San Francisco, and we had an event with him, and he cooked 2 pounds of lard, and he set off the fire alarm of the entire building because it was so flavorful, and but he said, "I eat lard almost every day, and you cannot tell." I mean, he looks great and healthy and full of life and wonderful. So yes, what we know and what we don't know, so true. We do want to talk about milk, though. And today you have you published a great book, or an article that really looked in depth into milk production. Sally Fallon Morell, who is a great advocate of raw food as well, talked about the cultural and historical use of milk. And you, as an expert of milk production as well, we would love to dive into that world with you. Raw versus pasteurized versus ultra-pasteurized. Can you give us the overview of what we are encountering with the different types of milk that are offered?
Certainly, and first just let me compliment you on the approach you're taking, because milk is complex culturally, it's complex in terms of production, and it's complex nutritionally. And there aren't short answers about milk, except to say that if you thrive on it, great. If you don't worry. And that there are many milks to choose from if you don't thrive on it.
Yes.
So let's start with the heat treatment, which is in...
So raw is not treated at all, right?
That's right. In one sense, heat treatment of milk has been a boon to public health, and in another, it has not. So raw or unpasteurized milk comes straight from the cow, and it is ideally strained and chilled immediately and kept at a nice cool temperature all along the food chain till it gets to your refrigerator and beyond. And the key to keeping milk fresh is a low temperature. So it's always been a challenge in hot countries and climates and in places where the food chain is longer than it might be to keep milk fresh.
And I've seen studies where actually people are concerned about bacteria, of course, in this country more than maybe other countries. And that study indicated or showed that the naturally occurring antibiotic properties of milk, which makes milk such a great food for many, actually keep check of the bad bacteria that you don't want, to a degree where raw milk is actually, you could say, safer than any pasteurized milk.
Well, that can be true in the right circumstances, but the chief thing that most people need to remember, and even the USDA is correct about, is that fresh milk is highly perishable, and there are ways to make it less apt to spoil, and the main one is to keep it cool, but the sort of situation you're thinking of is perhaps a yogurt maker, a raw milk cheese maker who is culturing milk, leaving it in fairly controlled environments. In that case, and with care and knowledge, the good bacteria can definitely wipe out the bad ones. That wouldn't be a reliable way for the average mother of three like me to keep her milk around for man, woman, and child to drink.
Yeah, so
we should probably make that distinction. But shall we just define for your listeners the pasteurization terms for a minute?
Yes.
Yeah, let's do that.
So heat treatment came about partly here in New York City because there was a period when dairies had moved from the country where they belong near fresh grass into cities, and the cows were kept next to whiskey distilleries where they were fed spent whiskey mash. The cows were unhealthy. The people milking the cows were often unhealthy, and cow and human diseases like brucellosis and TB spread easily between cow and human and milk, and did sicken a lot of infants and children. And so in response to these dirty dairies, for that's what they were, New York State and other states, one by one, began mandatory pasteurization and probably saved some lives. But they were taking a lousy product and trying to improve it slightly. So the contrasting product would be make a traditional food in the traditional manner with the traditional safeguards and then treat it properly, and then it will be healthy. Because here's the downside of pasteurization. It does damage heat-sensitive nutrients. And the most damaging of all forms of pasteurization is ultra-high temperature, or UHT, pasteurization. And this is when they treat the milk for just a second or two at very high temperatures, 275 degrees Fahrenheit, which renders it effectively sterile. They then package it in aseptic packaging, where it now has a pretty long shelf life of nearly 6 months, sometimes without refrigeration in certain kinds of packaging.
Well,
and this
that's...
has been a boon to milk distribution, because the milk just does not spoil. On the other hand, it's completely dead.
And that's in sharp contrast to even just pasteurization, which is what, at 145 degrees, is that correct?
Yes. So then in the middle is gentle pasteurization, which I respect and buy gently pasteurized milk. So while we're glad to drink clean, fresh, raw milk when we can get it, we can't always get it, and we know it spoils. It was Sally who first said to me, eat foods that spoil, but eat them before they do. And I throw out a lot of raw milk. I pour it on our grass, and a lot of farmers are now fertilizing their grass with raw milk, and there are great studies now out of grazing states like Wisconsin showing that raw milk itself is a terrific fertilizer for cows eating grass. Anyway, so a gently pasteurized milk is what you will get from a smaller, conscientious, probably grass-based regional dairy and creamery when they are not expecting to ship their milk long distances, when they're not expecting it to sit on shelves for a long time. They have high turnover. And that's more like 145 degrees, although that varies somewhat. And batch pasteurization is a term you might hear. That means the milk is all poured into a vat rather than pushed through lots of little tubes. It's just a little gentler, and it does preserve more, and the milk will still spoil.
So raw, pasteurized, and ultra-pasteurized as the general categories that one might find in the store.
Yes, sir. And let's talk about the UHT for just a minute. It does create what cooks know as the Maillard reaction. This is the browning or caramelizing reaction, which we all love in a pan sauce or with meats. It produces a pronounced cooked flavor, which is a little bit almost sugary, which I can readily identify, and oddly enough is not that unpleasant if you've been raised on UHT milk. But you can assume that it's overcooked, because milk does not, should not be browned.
So what is?
And then it damages. It greatly reduces the amount of folate in the milk, vitamin B12, vitamin C. These are all heat sensitive, and even the fatty acids in milk, the polyunsaturated or omega-3 fatty acids in milk, which are not many but are relevant, especially if the cow has been raised on grass, are not heat stable.
Nina, before
I once read one nifty thing way back when in the 40s, the U.S. government said that a person could get all the vitamin C he needed merely from drinking raw milk. This is no longer the case with pasteurized milk, so now we took all the vitamin C he needed merely from drinking raw milk. This is no longer the case with pasteurized milk, so now we turn to orange juice and so on. So you see how traditional foods once supplied us with the nutrients that we require.
Well, we want to talk about not all milk is created equal, both in the way it's preserved, but also the different categories of milk. But before we dive into that, what is the? Can you tell us in 1 minute what's condensed milk?
Oh, condensed milk has basically been boiled down, and then the traditional industrial product is also sweetened. And then there's powdered milk, another way to reduce milk, and that in modern times is spray dried. So they spray the milk through a screen like you might have on your window, only much finer, and the milk is broken down into tiny little particles and then dried under high heat.
Yes, and
that is how we create powdered milk. And this is another food scandal in that it does not anymore resemble the fresh product. And most of you listeners have probably drunk, some in the last week.
Nina Plank with us today on An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And Nina Plank is an author, a farmer's daughter, food writer, food advocate, and also she published her book, Real Food, What to Eat and Why, just recently. And Nina, we covered the preservation of milk or the different forms, but also there are different types of milk in the marketplace, Mark.
Yeah, I was wondering, can you just kind of tell us, I mean, is whole milk whole milk? I mean, does it just come from the cow and is that how it works? And what is low fat? What is skim? What are all these things, all these choices we have in the marketplace?
Well, good questions. Whole milk mostly is, or should be, fresh fluid milk. The term in the industry is fluid milk. That means what comes from the cow. All that goes into a big tank, the milk of many thousands of cows and many hundreds of dairies is all swish-washed together, and that is still fluid milk. It is then pasteurized, and it begins to be broken down into its component parts and then divided up and reassembled and repackaged and sold to you, usually at a higher price, with the good parts removed and bad parts added.
So when we, just to explain that, I learned about this recently, low fat or no fat or 2% milk, basically what happens to the milk, it breaks down or it's being broken down into water, solids, and fat, and then according to industry standards, put back together. That's what you were just saying, right?
Exactly. So I know of no one who's breaking up whole milk and reassembling it, but it is very common to create the spray-dried skim milk powder, or in rare cases, whole milk powder, but hardly anybody wants it for anything anymore. Adele Davis, said it was good nutrition, but everyone's now afraid of the fat. Anyway, to break it up into concentrated milk protein. And the water, of course, is of no consequence, and the fat is removed, and for good reason. The butter fat traditionally has been the most valuable thing a cow produces because it goes to things like butter or cheese or ice cream or creme fraiche or sour cream that have higher butter fat content than cow milk. And then so for skim and non-fat milk, they take this spray-dried skim milk powder. And a disadvantage of that is that the cholesterol, the fresh, natural, not bad for you, cholesterol is oxidized, which is bad for you and tends to raise your LDL. So they add that, they take that powder to wherever you and I live, and they pour some water in it, and they reconstitute the milk and call it skim milk. However, that's not on the label, which is frustrating. So if you wanted a high-quality fluid skim milk, there's no guarantee of getting it, although if you go with a small regional dairy, they are producing skim milk the way we would have when I was little and we had a cow. Namely, you get a 5-gallon bucket from Mabel, you strain it, you pour it out, you pour it into big jars, you let the cream rise to the top, you skim off the cream, and what's left is going to be that bluish skim milk. That would be...
Sure.
Original skim fluid milk.
Milk, such a complex topic. Who knew? With us, Nina Plank, author of Real Food, What to Eat and Why. And her website is Nina Plank. That's Nina, PLANCK.com. Nina, thanks so much for making the time to be with us today. Great to have you.
My pleasure. Raise a glass to milk.
Yes. Bottoms up. Thank you, Nina. Great. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And we are talking about the whole story, milk. Today on An Organic Conversation, we have another great guest coming up, a cheesemonger, as we are looking into the uses of milk, the many, many different uses coming up right here. Stay tuned for more.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Are you interested in making healthy food your profession? Bowman College is a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Their professional training programs prepare individuals for successful careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Study at one of four locations in California and Colorado, or learn from home in a self-paced mentor distance learning program. Find out more about their classes on holistic nutrition and culinary arts at BowmanCollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N College.org.
Trace, the new signature restaurant at the W San Francisco, is committed to creating an enriching and thoughtful culinary experience. By fusing the vibrant local personality of the Bay Area with a dedication to socially responsible food, Trace ensures all the ingredients are traceable back to their natural origins, locally sourced and sustainable. For reservations, visit trace-sf.com, T-R-A-C-E-sf.com, or call 415-817-7836.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
Today, about the whole story of milk, we have a great guest coming up, Gordon Atger, cheesemonger and author of Alive on the Wedge. But before we welcome Gordon about the multiple uses of milk, here's Chef Sita with your holistic bite.
Thanks, Helga. Well, talking about milk today, I thought I might use this opportunity to talk a little bit about goat milk, because I didn't think we were going to get to that since we're talking mostly about cow here. So goat milk is interesting, more digestible for a lot of people than cow's milk. There is the fat that's in goat milk is a natural antacid, so it's very soothing on your digestive system. It's also antimicrobial, which means that it can help to fight bacteria in the body. And because it has different proteins in cow's milk, those proteins tend to be less allergenic for many people. So if you have a difficult time with traditional milk, you might be fine with goat milk. And you can get goat milk in the milk form, in the cheese form, and in the yogurt form. And I think that the best and most authentic Greek yogurt really is from goat milk. But if you're not ready to make that big of a change in your morning routine, then switch to traditional goat feta. If you're a feta person, probably most of the feta you're buying in the States is cow's feta. But goat feta, like I said, which is very traditional, is so delicious. It's really tangy, and it's a great place to introduce some of these different health benefits into your diet. So one of my favorite ways to enjoy goat feta is in my stuffed Mediterranean bell peppers with quinoa and herbs. And it is it's also a very seasonal dish, because your bell peppers are like, right, you know, they got a couple weeks left at this time of year. And I also like to make this dish with black quinoa and orange bell peppers. And then you've got the black and the orange together, which kind of looks like Halloween. And I swear to you, the first time I did this for Halloween, I actually I sliced the pepper in half, and the half that goes on top, I cut like a jack-o'-lantern. So you're looking at this pepper and it's orange and you see the black quinoa underneath, and you've got crumbled goat feta and parsley and basil and mint, which makes it also very Mediterranean, all mixed into that mixture. So that is the recipe you will find on our website and on our Facebook page this week, the stuffed Mediterranean bell pepper with goat feta, quinoa, and herbs on anorganicconversation.com.
And that was this week's Holistic Bite with Chef Sita. Sita, I love it. It's hilarious how you play with food and yet take it seriously all the time at the same time. And You are a chef and you're a holistic nutritionist, and it seems like such an appropriate blend to be both.
I think so.
What you know, how to cook it, but also what you do when you cook it and what it does to you. Beautiful. And milk is such a complex topic.
It is. Yeah. I mean, when we didn't really touch much on fermented milks today, but people, again, who have a difficult time with traditional milk might be lactose intolerant, which means that they're allergic to the milk sugars. And they might be fine with yogurt and cheese, because in yogurt and cheese, the bacteria, the healthy bacteria that's already in existence there, has started converting the sugar. So there's less of that. So you might be fine with that. And also, I really want to stress how important it is that you buy grass-fed, organic, antibiotic, and hormone-free milk, dairy, because it comes from the cow, and the cow, as with beef, you've got to look for those things, grass-fed, organic, antibiotic, and hormone-free. And because cows are raised longer than chickens, if they were raised in poor condition and they have higher toxin levels, they're actually more concentrated in the milk and in the cow than it would be in poor chicken. So really make sure with your dairy that you're buying excellent quality, grass-fed, organic, antibiotic, and hormone-free.
And I know that our next guest wouldn't agree more. Gordon Edgar, cheesemonger and the author of A Life on the Wedge, calling in from San Francisco, California, with an amazing website. The website is gordonzola.net. Gordon, it's so fun to have you on the show. Thanks for being part of it.
Well, you know, cheese lends itself to puns. You kind of have to have a pun if you have a cheese website.
Yes.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm sure you heard what Sita just said, and you couldn't agree more on that. The quality of the milk really defines the quality of the cheese, right? Can you make it just with wine? Can you make a good cheese with bad milk?
I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the cheese making process, and I think that, you know, generally you're definitely starting with a handicap unless you start with really good milk, and that definitely shows in the cheese. I mean, I think you can make a decent cheese with not the best quality milk, but you can never make a really great cheese with not good milk.
Mm-hmm. And then how, you know, Sita was just saying that when you culture it, it changes. What happens during the process of when you get a batch of milk? How do you start? How do you make cheese? What happens to the changes for milk and for the enzymes, the proteins? Does it become a new food?
I would say that. I mean, I think the best way to think about cheese is, it's a way to extend the life of milk. Milk is a very perishable product, very perishable food. And cheese, when you make cheese, it's a way to keep it for, up to, a couple years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever, depending on how you're making it. So and basically, you start with milk, as you said, hopefully really good quality milk. And then you add your cultures and your rennet. And what that does is it starts the process of coagulation. You're basically separating out the milk solids from the liquids to make a firmer product, one that'll last longer. It's hard to talk in general about cheese a little bit because there's
sure.
so many different recipes. So anything I say here, you could probably find an exception to. But,
and so many different cows and milk. Mark, you had a comment on that.
Well, I was just wondering, there are different cows that have different type of milk fat. You know, which milk makes the different types of cheeses,
Well, there's, most cheese made in this country, most milk produced in this country comes from Holstein cows. And the reason that they're used most often is because they have the biggest yield. It's not necessarily for the properties that you get into the milk. It's not because of the fat content or the proteins and all that. It's mostly because you get a bigger volume and it's more cost effective for large scale farming, right? One of the things that people have been doing, and especially in the last decade or so, is going to Jersey milk, which is something that people used to do a lot more, 50, 100 years ago. And Jersey milk always has higher butter fat.
And those are the brown, fuzzy, sweet little, right?
Yeah. Well, it's all sweet in their own way.
Holsteins are black and white, and then there's Jerseys, which are brown, dark brown.
Right, exactly. And they're smaller cows,
yes.
Therefore they have less yield of milk a day. And you can actually see it in the cheese. When you make cheese with that, generally speaking, the milk is going to be much yellower because it has much more butter fat in the process. But there's also, the other thing I want to just add to that before we leave, the cows to milk question is, there's a lot of, traditional cheeses that are name controlled, which means, they're controlled, they're protected names. so that somebody, you know, in some other country or somewhere else can't make this, a cheese and call it under the same name.
Oh, do you have an example for that?
Yeah, and this is where I was going to get into with the cows. A cheese like Gruyère de Comté, which is a French Alpine cheese, basically, you know, Gruyère Swiss style, you know, cheese. You know, it has to be made only with the milk of Montbéliard cows, which are the cows from that region, you know, that are used to that kind of alpine, you know, environment and you know, give the milk a very particular taste, which, you know, comes off in the cheese. So, you know, someone making a very similar style of cheese elsewhere in the world, it's never going to taste exactly the same. And that's why they control what can go into a cheese that's called Comté.
So legally, you would need to bring in the milk from those cows to make that in Washington, D.C. or New York or San Francisco?
Well, because it's name controlled, you can actually only make it in the Alpine region of
France.
It's
like champagne.
But exactly. Even if you did, wanted to just copy it completely, you might try those cows, but you know, in a different environment, you know, the milk wouldn't necessarily taste the same because they're eating native grasses and native, you know, plants.
Gordon, we have some burning cheese questions for you. I think these are things that everybody wants to know the answer to, and you're so the man for the question. Can you always eat the rind of cheese, or which rinds and molds are edible and which ones aren't?
Well, you know, this is a question. It's funny. This is a question that always comes up whenever I was doing readings for my book and that kind of thing. You know, basically, you know, as a cheesemonger, I have no opinion whatsoever as to whether you're going to eat the rind or not. You should eat it if you like it. You should not eat it.
I love it.
Like Sally
Liberating,
Fallon.
Right?
Eat it raw, but before it spoils. That's so funny.
Great. Well, what about keeping cheese fresh? Like talking about eating it before it spoils. Do you have any tips on how to store it well? And also about ripening cheeses? I mean, some people might think that when they purchase a cheese that it's ready to eat, but are there some cheeses that ripen, they get better if they're aged a little bit longer?
Well, you know, definitely two different questions. You know,
yeah, for sure.
First, I'd say for, you know, for most cheese, you should only buy what you're going to eat that week. Cheese, once it is cut, is not something that's meant to last. Cheese, once it's cut, is something meant to be eaten right away. An uncut cheese, you know, and for most consumers, you know, that limits you to like, you know, kind of small sized, you know, mini wheels of brie or something like that.
Yes.
You know, that's the kind of thing that you can let ripen a little bit if you like it a little stronger. But, you know, really, I would say, you know, even if this sounds self-serving, you should go to a place that that knows cheese and is selling you cheese and can tell you when it'll be ripe. Because, you know, doing that on your own, you know, you can waste a lot of money. But you know, I'd say, and for cheese storage, it really depends on what kind of cheese you're talking about. You know, again, the best thing to do is to eat it quickly. But if you have something with like a bloomy rind or a sticky rind, you probably want to use a wax paper because a plastic will really start a deterioration of that rind that will be kind of unpleasant to taste. You know, with a blue cheese, wax paper or actually tinfoil works well. But if you have a cheese and you want to keep it for a while and you don't want it to dry out in a way that it'll mold or a way that you'll have to trim off cheese, you know, there's really no better option than tightly wrapped plastic for that. And definitely not Ziploc bags because, you know, Ziploc bag with lots of air in it is just asking for a moldy cheese.
And Gordon Edgar, cheesemonger and author of Alive on the Wedge with a really great website, Gordon Zola. .net with lots of tips, cheese trips, really explaining and celebrating your world of cheese that you are so passionate about today on An Organic Conversation. Gordon, we are out of time, unfortunately, but it was such a pleasure, and we realized that the world of milk and cheese production will deserve another show. We will definitely have you back. Thanks so much for making the time today to be with us. Great
right,
to have
thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gordon. And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thanks for listening.
An Organic Production, An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. I'm totally in the world of cheese. Associate producer is Kristen Ponger. Production assistants are Lauren Mulcahy and Vanessa Farron.
If you missed parts of this show or for any other episode, go to iTunes or anorganicconversation.com.
And we love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share at anorganicconversation.com. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
Mark Mulcahy.
And Sita Rani Bryan.
And we will be back right here, same place, same time next week. See you then.
Bye-bye
now.
And you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take.
take you out of this place. Someone you can lend a hand in return.